Welcome to the Essential Knowledge Updates from the Royal College of General Practitioners. Today we are discussing the recent NICE guidance on the management of dyspepsia. My name is Sally Higginbottom and I am a GP and EKU author. I will be interviewing the EKU module author, Dr. Louise Newson. Dr. Newson is a GP, an EKU author and a medical educator. Welcome, Louise.
Hello.
So I thought it was a very interesting module. Can you tell me what surprised you when you were writing it?
Dyspepsia is something extremely common. We're all aware of it. We see it a lot. But actually, I realised as I was writing it, I don't know much about it. One of the things, even in one of the first few slides, I've even written that there's no standard definition for dyspepsia. So that in itself is quite confusing because it's a word we use a lot, a term we use a lot, but actually we don't really know what it means or what it means for patients. And then not to be able to diagnose it easily means it's quite hard to manage. And there's quite a lot of confusion even into the epidemiological data as to whether it's increased risk with smokers or not smokers. So then I thought, well, if it's not really increased with smokers, how is stopping smoking going to count? So there's lots of little things that I found, it's like anything really, the more you read about it, the more confusing it can be. So I found it quite difficult and challenging, I suppose.
Yes, I mean, I was quite surprised. I'm sure I remember working out at great length whether proper reflux or a different sort of dyspepsia, and all that seems to have gone out the window, and it seems to not greatly matter exactly someone's symptoms are showing because you treat them all the same anyway, or at least that was the sort of sense I've got. Is that fair?
Well, I think it is. I mean, obviously I'm speaking as a generalist. I don't have a specialist interest in gastroenterology, so I am really just reviewed it as a GP and tried to make it, you know, user-friendly for a GP. The only thing is that there's some very subtle differences between the amount of time for treatment with a PPA or ranitidine. So for example, it's 8 weeks for those with a non-steroidal related peptic ulcer, but it says 6 to 8 weeks for those with a peptic ulcer and H. pylori, 4 to 8 weeks for those with just a peptic ulcer. So the difference is really just a couple of weeks, or 4 weeks at the maximum. And I think actually in general practice, often we'll give a couple of months anyway. So I think to actually really to split hairs over 1 or 2 weeks difference, I don't see in routine practice it's going to make that much difference really. So you're right. I think what we call it or what causes it is not as important as how we treat it really. I think the other big thing is the whole testing for H. pylori. That's something else that I learned really when I was doing it, thinking, oh, I think I under-investigate. And then I spoke to some of my partners and we all thought that maybe we under-investigate a bit for H. pylori. And I don't know whether other general practices are the same or what your practice is, but that was our general feeling about it.
So what testing do you like to use for H. pylori?
Locally, we do the serology testing, which, again, the NICE guidelines are quite clear that it's only if it's been locally validated, which I'm presuming ours is, but they're saying about breath test or stool antigen test, but I'm not sure how common they are offered. But obviously, it is very important that people with uninvestigated dyspepsia are investigated for H. pylori.
Yes, I mean, certainly locally, we do have both stool antigen testing and breath testing. The stool antigen testing is greatly easier, at least from a clinician perspective, because you just give the patient a pot and a form and send them on their way, whereas the breath testing takes 2 or 3 appointments with a nurse to do it. So I can see why the serology is appealing. But my understanding is the serology, once it's gone positive, stays positive. So it doesn't help you work out whether they've got H. pylori now or...
No, so it's only helpful if it's negative.
Yes, so that can be a little bit tricky, but it is an interesting question, and I guess it depends what your lab offers as to what your options are going to be. I was quite interested in the drugs that increase the risk of dyspepsia. I mean, some of them are obvious, NSAIDs, bisphosphonates, but I was quite surprised about calcium channel blockers. I don't think I put those on my list of dyspepsia-causing drugs.
No, it is something, and I think the calcium antagonists are used more and more, aren't they? I think they went out of fashion and now they're back in fashion, and certainly I've got patients who have actually on calcium antagonists for rate control for atrial fibrillation, and I've got a couple who have presented with a cough, and it's actually related to their calcium antagonist, which is something that I hadn't really thought about, but yes. It's always worth thinking about drugs, because obviously the first treatment is lifestyle, and it's not just reaching for your prescription pad for the good old PPI. It's actually thinking so, and drugs has got to be at the top of the list. Is that there's any way of moderating or reducing or changing the drugs that they're on? It's going to have a bigger impact and also be a lot more cost effective than just giving more medicines.
Giving another drug, yes, absolutely, yeah. Yes. And similarly, theophyllins, which just wasn't on my radar particularly for this condition. I was also interested in how it was linked to IBS. There's a sense that, because IBS, my instinctive feeling is, I think about lower GI symptoms. It was quite interesting, I think. It makes complete sense, but it was interesting to flag up.
Yes, and I think that's interesting also when talking about the management, there is a little mention about the psychological therapy, so cognitive behavioural therapy, psychotherapy, is saying might help short term. And again, that I was wondering whether that's linked with IBS, because there is some evidence, isn't there, that some of the psychological treatments help with irritable bowel as well. So this sort of whole overlap, whether it's related to diet, who knows, I suppose. There's not enough work's being done at the moment.
No, absolutely, but yeah, a potential area for looking at. Thinking about treatment, it seems now that first line is very much PPIs for H2 antagonists for those that don't tolerate a PPI, or is that your sense from the guidance?
Yes, I mean, they still do talk a lot about the H2 receptor antagonist treatment, and even for those who don't respond adequately to a PPI, which I think is interesting, because I always thought, well, PPIs are stronger, they're better. So if someone hasn't responded, they're not likely to respond to ranitidine, for example, whereas these are saying, actually, you can try ranitidine, which I think is interesting. Also on the management, it is actually thinking about surgical treatment, which I think is something that's probably becoming more common. And certainly I've got a lot of patients that have had long-term symptoms and are just sick of taking tablets all the time. Mm. And it is an indication for those who don't want to carry on with long-term acid reduction or therapy that actually considering surgery is a good option.
Yes, absolutely. I honestly can't remember ever referring anyone for surgery for this indication, which implies there must be people I've missed that would have benefited from it. I think that is a real flag to look for.
Definitely.
Because I think we're also increasingly aware of the downsides of long-term PPIs.
Well, there's certainly been a lot. I mean, this isn't touched in this AKU, but things people with low magnesium levels, they're not without risk, some of the medication, especially for those who are needing it in the long term. And obviously there's a big mention in the guidelines about people should be on the lowest dose for the shortest period of time, which is the same for any long-term medication really, and also using them PRN, which is something that I think in the past they haven't really been used. We've always talked to patients about having a short course, but actually they are allowed to use them PRN, and I think this is really important because it will help reduce the prescriptions that we're prescribing. Well, it's obviously more cost effective, and it's also giving patients more control over their symptoms, which is got to be a good thing, really.
Absolutely, because similarly, I think, you know, the long-term medications we prescribe, often we nag our patients to take reliably, so they're antihypertensives or they're statins or whatever, we say you must take this every day, and it's quite interesting to have a long-term medication that we say it's fine, put it in the cupboard, use it when you need it for a few days, which is how a lot of doctors use PPIs, but it's nice to know we can use that with our patients, that it's a sort of sanctioned use of and that this would lead to a lower total drug use, as you say.
The cost of dyspepsia is estimated about £1 billion a year. I mean, that's phenomenal, isn't it? And it probably will increase. But, so the number of prescriptions is increasing. So yes, anything that's going to help and reduce that has got to be a good thing, really.
Yes, and with the, as we were mentioning, the long-term risks, I think there's increasing evidence of pneumonias and C. diff, and you know that actually you need a degree of acid in your stomach to protect you from various bugs. And so I think this gives people a way of getting down to a lower dose over time. It seems like it's certainly something I will take back to use more actively to tell people that it's fine to cut back once they've got their symptoms under control, and just have a few more when things flare. So the other thing that struck me when I was reading it was around Barrett's, that it's sort of in a slightly coded way, the guidance and the module say that sometimes it's not in a patient's best interest to be under Barrett's surveillance if they're known to have Barrett's, presumably because they would not be in a position to benefit from treatment if they get cancer. Is that...
Well, I'm not sure, it was a bit vague about it, but it clearly says that the harms of endoscopic surveillance might outweigh the benefits in those who are at low risk. So I think it's those that have had recurrent endoscopies, not shown any progression, and haven't got other risk factors, then yes, they're saying, you know, which I think is important, because we've always, or certainly my medical school training was, it's pre-malignant disease, most, you know, it will progress at some stage, whereas this isn't quite saying that.
Yes, and it's sort of part of a growing sense that I think we've got across a number of disease categories, a number of cancers, that we're starting to understand that there's not an inevitable progression from some pre-malignancies into malignancies, and so we need to be a little bit more nuanced about how hard and heavily we follow people up, which I think is quite an interesting area altogether.
Totally. Which again is good, because it's individualising care, which is something that's obviously very good and important, and it's clearly taking into their risk, it does say their risk factors, but also their preference. So some people might not actually want to be having so many endoscopic investigations if their risk is low.
No, and some people who started on surveillance, you know, 10, 15, 20 years ago, who might now be really quite elderly and frail, and their ability to benefit, you know, the point of surveillance is presumably early surgery if you find a malignancy. Once someone passes a point where they wouldn't be a candidate for surgery because of their frailty or their comorbidities or whatever, you wonder quite what you're doing the surveillance for, really. Yes, again, it's that sort of GP's role in sometimes saying it's okay to stop doing things, and to have, as you say, an individualised discussion with a patient about the pros and cons of a not particularly pleasant procedure that may not do them net benefit. It was another sort of flag in that direction. That was interesting stuff. If there was one take-home message you'd want to put into people's minds around dyspepsia, what would that be?
I think it would probably be about what we've discussed already about the use of PPIs, not being scared of using the high dose, which it talks about, and also not being scared about stopping them for a trial, and also the PRN dosing, which I think is really important. So they do talk about an annual review, which I think is hard in these times of general practice.
Yes.
But we have so many patients, and I'm sure you do too, who it's just on their repeat. It's just reissued without any discussion because the patients are fine. But actually, to try and talk to the patient when we're issuing their prescription for maybe something else, to just ask them if they've had any symptoms recently, and if they haven't, say, well, how about coming off this, and with a view to restarting if you have symptoms. And I think that would, you know, I think that would be something that I'm already changing in my practice just from doing this EKU.
Well, that's great. I think that is a very practical point that we can incorporate fairly seamlessly into our practice, and that will make our prescribing advisors happy as well. So everyone wins, and hopefully patients have a lower drug burden and more benefit. That's great. Thank you very much for your time.
You have been listening to the Essential Knowledge Update from the Royal College of General Practitioners.